Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, good morning. This is Brother Blur from the Happiness Addiction Show. I have a couple of people with me this morning, and we're going to talk about drugs or substance abuse in the workplace. But first, we're going to talk a little bit about the upcoming HBO series that will be airing on the 15th through the 18th on HBO, and it covers a whole host of subjects, including drugs in the workplace, insurance, and a whole other, and lots of things. And I'm really recommending that everybody take a chance and view it. It will be well worth their while. But getting back to today's show, since we've got a couple people here ready to talk about it, we're going to talk a little bit about, I'm going to let them introduce themselves, and from there we're going to go on into our discussion. Helen, why don't you start first?
Good morning. My name is Helen Sperling. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I work at Brandon House, a residential treatment facility.
Chuck?
Sure. Hi. Hi, Levy. How you doing?
Hi.
I'm Chuck Krug. I'm a management side labor and employment attorney and human resources counselor in Chicago.
Okay. Chuck, would you do me a favor and tell them a little bit about what's incorporated in your practice?
Yeah, I do, well, like I said, management side labor and employment law. I handle HR-related issues for clients that are small to medium-sized businesses in the Chicago metro area. That involves policy and practice development, litigation, representation, alternative dispute resolution, training on HR-related issues relative to drug and alcohol types of issues. That includes counseling or consulting with them on testing issues, how to create a drug-free work environment if that's what their goal is, how to recognize problems with drugs or alcohol, how to handle them, things like that.
Tell me, give me a little insight on just what is the average small to medium-sized employer looking for? What are they doing now? What kind of stuff are they doing right now in terms of drug-free workplace or drug policies and stuff like that?
Well, I think the focus is on retention of hired employees. So when you're talking about current or incumbent employees, you're talking about recognizing signs of problems relative to alcohol, drugs, if it's abuse or addiction or just casual use, you know, trying to identify what the situation is and whether or not they should refer the employee to some sort of program, whether it's an employee assistance program or some sort of third-party program or hospital, in-house or inpatient treatment facility, whatever, you know, those types of treatment places. And then prior to employment, you're talking about really the incumbent or the key question is whether or not to test. Is drug, alcohol abuse or usage, is that actually relevant to the job in question? Is that part of the essential functions of the job to not use drugs or alcohol?
Helen, do you come across, I mean, I know you work in a residential treatment facility. Do many of the people that come to your facility, are they working? Do they come there via the state, or do they come there with insurance? I mean, just give me a sense of what your population looks like.
You know, I think our population does not have insurance. So some of them might have jobs and have left their jobs due to their addiction. But mostly I think we do not have private insurance in this facility.
Okay. So, I mean, what it sounds like is that, Chuck, you're trying to find ways to keep people away from those kind of long-term commitments as far as insurance and the stuff is like by screening and identifying what the employee looks like or sounds like or acts like for the employer to choose whether or not they're going to hire them or not. Is that a fair expression?
No, actually, it's a little skewed. What we're looking at is it's hard. You can't come up with a profile, I think, for drug or alcohol use, abuse, you know, addiction. what we're trying to, on the pre-employment side, what you're doing is, I mean, the basic concept is that nobody's going to look, or no candidate, job candidate's going to look as good after being hired as they are before being hired. I mean, they're going to put on their best face for you. And basically what you focus on besides resume and credentials is also their behavior. And you focus on, it's really behavioral oriented. So, you know, you can't really say if they act bizarrely that it's necessarily drugs or alcohol. It could be could just be their personality or some sort of psychological or psychiatric disorder or whatever. So I wouldn't label it one way or the other. You're just focusing on behavior and trying to figure out, you know, if you should or shouldn't hire that person.
So give me some of the clues some of the behaviors that you would look for.
I think lack of eye contact, looking in one direction or the other, obvious inconsistencies in things that they say or in things that they've given you, like the resume or any references, things like that, references that don't check out, credentials that don't check out, like I said, inconsistent statements, verbal statements, or inconsistent statements that are given in writing, just behavior that won't seem, personality-wise, that just won't seem to fit in with your current workplace or that doesn't match the essential functions or duties of the job.
Helen, when you're counseling patients, what kinds of things do you work on in terms of the kind of behaviors you're trying to get them to see as being detrimental to their long-term health? I mean, I'm sure you're trying to get them to sobriety, but what kind of steps do you take before you get them to sobriety?
You know, I really think that the key issue is self-esteem. I think that's the biggest starting point. Many of my patients are, you know, feeling less than and feeling like they're not worthy and pretty much beaten down. And once you can get their self-esteem bolstered, they, I think, are more receptive to, you know, working on the key issues that are behind the use. Certainly not every person has an issue attached to the use, but, you know, a vast majority do.
Well, that sounds like, I mean, the idea of inconsistencies or needing to tell stories that aren't quite true, not looking at people when they talk to them, those sounds like, would those be signs of
self-esteem issues? Yeah.
Self-esteem issues?
Absolutely.
Okay, so that means that there's a resonance between what you're having an employer look for and what someone who might be suffering from one of those kinds of problems might demonstrate.
Right.
Yeah. Helen put it really great too. I mean, that's a key concern too for employers, is that if they don't want to take on a lot of psychological or psychiatric baggage with an employee, because you know they want to train the employee for the job, but they don't want to really, they may not have the money or the resources to actually create a person, create an identity.
When you're talking about this employee, are we talking about people who are hourly waged, or are we talking about executives, or are we talking, does it run the full range, or is it more segmented than I'm describing it?
No, I think it runs the range. I don't think it's that segmented, because I think the higher paid executive could potentially, I mean, you may want to spend more time and money trying to rehab them, but they could also potentially do more damage and create more notoriety, because you've seen that with high-profile companies where with drugs or sexual types of behavior, you know, like Boeing is an example a couple of years ago where they lost their CEO because of a relationship with a female subordinate. So, I mean, you know, the higher the profile, the higher the executive is in the hierarchy, potentially the more damage and notoriety they can attain.
By the way, I mean, the one thing I wanted to sort of cover with you, give me a sense of what is covered under psychiatric or insurance kinds of care that employers are offering these days.
I think employers are focusing more on wellness overall and prevention. I think there's a turn toward that, so they're trying to prevent abuse, usage, or addiction of drugs and alcohol and substances. They're trying to focus more on fitness, more on, you know, family health, things like that.
I mean, but there used to be that, you know, you had 21 days in some sort of care, whether it be psychological or whatever, and that was it for, your lifetime. Is that, does that still sort of hold?
Yeah, I think, but it also depends on the insurance provider. Prevents, you know, the insurance provider, the employee assistance program, whatever outsourced or third party sort of provider that the business or, you know, the company's using.
And I think it's also a dollar amount at that point.
Yeah.
So
it'd be like whatever dollar amount they allow for that particular issue, you know. But, you know, I think from an employment perspective, it's an issue, you know, when someone is employed and, how, you know, it's not that easy to have someone leave because if they, because of a Disability Act and other factors that, you know, work in here. Isn't that true?
Yeah, Chuck? Definitely is, because once you're aware of the problem, whether it's the addiction or the abuse, and if they decide, if the employee decides to seek treatment, they're probably then protected under any state, local, or federal Disability Act.
Mm-hmm.
And you may be then on the hook for basically helping them along, you know, in their treatment or whatever.
Or at least refer them to an EAP or something,
yeah,
you know.
Refer them to some sort of treatment program.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I've done with some clients is to look at community-based programs or even religious, you know, faith-based programs for employees, because some of those are cheaper, or, you know, in some cases free, and they're easier to use.
Mm-hmm. And employers are directing their, I mean, how does the employer have a responsibility not to know about these kinds of issues? That's why they direct them to EAPs, or do they really want to know?
It's a fine balance, because then you're also dealing with HIPAA, the Health Privacy Act, that's federal. And basically, you know, some employers don't want to know because they think, you know, it's the employee's personal life and we don't want that sort of liability. But like I said, you can have problems with, you know, your reputation, you know, public relations issues, your reputation in the community for these individuals if they, you know, if it reflects back on the employer. So I think employers are taking more responsibility because they're trying to withstand those types of issues. And they want, you know, it is a fine line.
My thoughts on that were relative to the fact that I think employees usually sign a release for that information. Isn't that true?
Sometimes, but also the provider itself is encumbered by certain by legal restrictions too.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there could be issues that the employee may not want to sign a release for, or may not want to release, and the provider may have to honor those. A lot of this is still being, I wouldn't say written, but a lot of this is still being created, the regulations and rules. I'm sorry?
This is not settled law.
No.
Okay. So when you're working with an employer and they usually start off with a policy or not with a policy?
It depends. Some of them have policies, some of them don't. It depends on what. It really depends on the business itself, what the needs of the business are, and the needs of the job. I don't, you know, generally speaking, I don't think testing or notification is useful if the job itself doesn't require that. The essential functions don't require that.
Okay, so you're really sort of doing an analysis to start off with, is that you're trying to figure out if they need a policy at all before you start writing a policy.
That's right.
Does that take very much time to sort of put that together for make that analysis?
Yeah, it is sort of time consuming because you're sort of working with a patchwork of laws. So some laws apply, some laws don't. I mean, there's, you know, the state of Illinois and the U.S. government. They have drug-free workplace acts which require notification of controlled substances or drugs in the workplace, things like that. There's also rules or laws involving health examinations, things like that. So you really have to define what you want, not only relative to the job and the business, but relative to the actual laws that may or may not apply to that business or industry.
By the way, Helen, if it would be okay if you decided that you needed to get on, that not to stay, but I do want you to stay, but I wanted you to let you know that if you did need to go on, that would be okay.
Okay, very good.
All right. So, back to you for a second, Chuck. The number of employers you work with that sort of have had you do this, is that a very large number? Is that, you know, are most of these in the Chicagoland area, or can you do this sort of all over the country?
I could do this all over the country. Really, it depends on, a lot of it depends on the industry. For example, trucking, transportation, distribution have, they're in a completely different industry that's more highly regulated relative to drug and alcohol usage or any sort of substance usage. The same thing with aviation or rail, ground transportation, what have you. The same thing with anything involving any drug-related research, biopharmaceuticals, nanotechnology, or nanobiotechnology, what have you. So, I mean,
some of the things that I've come across recently, and it's sort of not really surprising, but I hadn't thought about it, were the number of nurses that were needing to go through drug recovery.
Yeah.
Because of the kinds of work they do and the amount of stress that's on them and the access they have to drugs, have you seen much of that?
Yeah, I have a client who's actually in the nurse staffing industry. And we've dealt with that sort of an issue relative to pre-employment screening and then keeping somebody on a board after they discover the issues. And it's a very difficult issue. I mean, especially if you're sympathetic and you want to retain that employee, they've been good. But how much exposure are you willing to encumber? How much expense is it? You know, how much expense is it going to be? Those are the types of issues you look at. Besides then also legally, I mean, what can you do once you've already employed or once you know that the person may have a problem?
Helen, you
yes.
still there?
Yes.
Have you come across, I mean, does that same kind of issue even affect people in your industry as far as counselors working with addicts? I mean, where do most of the counselors come from? Are they, you know, just sort of reformed addicts working their way through it?
I think a lot of our counselors are recovering addicts.
So they have the same issue in terms of trying to stay in away from relapse as the person that they are counseling.
Right. But, I mean, I think by the time they are a counselor, they have a stronghold on, you know, their recovery. And certainly, they're a really good role model for the population.
One of the questions that comes to my mind is when we talk about testing is I've read some things that said that primarily what testing does because of the way drugs affect the body, it is more successful at testing for things like marijuana than for alcohol. Or for any, I mean, it's hard to find sort of, because the way the body deals with opiates or other things, it sort of flushes that stuff out of the body real quickly. When you're talking to employers, or is that a question that gets asked very often?
Yeah, and actually what it leads to is you have to scrutinize your testing company or the company or the provider doing the testing and assessment as much as you are your employees. I mean, you don't want to get screwed either way.
And you don't want to pay for, I mean, because what do drug tests cost these days?
I've heard anywhere from about $10 up onto a couple hundred bucks or so,
you
know, per employee.
I mean, for a couple hundred bucks for the testing, you better show something.
You better show something, better be valid. I mean, it actually better test what you want to test and do it accurately. Something else, too, that Helen sort of alluded to, which is sort of a weird paradox in this, is that if you're dealing with job candidates who've had drug or alcohol problems and they've had criminal convictions, not necessarily that they're even connected to the drug or alcohol problems, there's a lot of industries that, by law, they can't hire the people with criminal convictions. And Helen sort of alluded to that a lot of these people are actually good role models. Because I had a client of mine in telemarketing sector, not-for-profit telemarketing, that was for a while was using people released from a halfway house, and these were the most reliable employees. But under Illinois law, you can't have convicted criminals around handling money or in the telemarketing services, so they were prevented then from using this halfway house service anymore. Yet they were the most reliable employees because these guys were constantly monitored.
I mean, that's really kind of a shame to sort of have someone who can really do the best job for you, who's really highly motivated to do the job because of their life situation has sort of made it clear to them that they need to. And at the same time, the same law that sort of has put them away keeps them away from gainful employment.
That's right. It's an unfortunate irony in this industry, and I think it also shows just really that we're still in our infancy in dealing with these issues. We're not that sophisticated yet.
I mean, because one of the problems, I mean, and we'll talk. I'm going to talk about this in the latter part of the week, is the question of prohibition, because those people who are looking at prohibition are saying, you know, it isn't so much the drug taking that's the problem, it's the drug prohibition that's the problem, because our jails are full of people who have minor drug abuse offenses, but they are just absolutely filled. The jails are filled to the maximum with those kinds of people. I think I read a report somewhere that last year that the FBI said there was something like 800,000 arrests for marijuana. 800,000 arrests just for marijuana. And that there was somewhere in the neighborhood of 20,000 prisoners in jail just because of marijuana. Now, think what you may about the goodness or badness of marijuana from a moral standpoint, but from just the cost of it alone, that's substantial.
Yeah.
That is substantial. And then you find that same person, because of their conviction, not being able to get a job, which ties it back to what you just described in terms of the paradox in the law.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and then it creates a vicious cycle. You know, you can't get a job. What are you going to do? Well, okay, maybe you could just go back to selling your drugs because there's good money in that.
I mean, it sort of self-perpetuates and sort of makes the situation nowhere near as clear as the law would want it to be, and the amount of money spent in drug prohibition is escalating year after year after year, and the number of people that are in jail are going up the same amount, plus the number of jail sales that you have to make.
Yeah, it kind of also justifies those individuals to say that marijuana is a gateway drug.
Right.
Maybe that's why it is.
Well, the other thing is, too, when do we say, okay, you could have a new start? Can we say that? Can we say you have a new start?
Well, I don't think that there's...
You come out of a conviction and you come into treatment and you have a situation where you have a felony that's hanging over you, and if you go through the complete your treatment and you go on and complete your probation or whatever, a lot of times some of these programs will drop the felony charge.
Yeah, there are expungement programs.
So hopefully, we're dealing with that, but when we're not, it feels very bleak for a lot of patients.
Is that very difficult to get something expunged like that?
I think it takes a lot of work and effort because I believe, first of all, it depends on the state where you're doing this, but it could be up to the governor, or it could be up to certain stipulations within the laws, the criminal laws. And I know of some politicians who are very involved in expungement. I just know that they're very committed to it, but it does take a lot of time and effort.
And it could be a stipulation attached to that particular charge.
Mm-hmm.
Does that work the same way for DUIs?
I don't know, to be honest with you. I don't know if there's expungement for DUIs or not.
No, I was just curious because DUIs, I mean, you hear about those all the time, and they have these programs that sort of, force people to go through these trainings and trying to figure out what their situation is and trying to make it better. So I was just thinking that might be someplace else where there can be some, not leniency, but at least intelligence about how you're treating different people to so that their lives just doesn't sort of fall apart.
I haven't heard of expungement for DUIs, and I think there'd be a lot of liability on the part of the court system and the state legislatures, because I don't think they'd want something like that tracked back to them should there be further problems with the individual.
Mm. Okay. I mean, that makes sense, too. That makes absolutely good sense.
My experience with expungements come mostly with felony, minor felonies or misdemeanors, things like that.
Okay. By the way, how long have you been doing how long have you been working in treatment?
I've been in this field for about 5 years.
Okay. So have you always worked at the kind of facility you are now, or have you sort of you've gone from one facility to another facility?
Yeah, I worked in outpatient services for a number of years and then came full-time into residential.
Is it basically the same? Do you basically do the same thing in both?
Yeah, it's similar in terms of the social work perspective. However, the population is different. It's a different flow to it, residential versus outpatient. I think outpatient, it's a little bit harder to get the patient to stay put, whereas here, here they are. It's sort of like a captive audience.
Well, I guess one of the issues that it comes to my mind is aftercare when you're dealing with residential. I mean,
that's a big problem. I mean, we don't have enough facilities that'll take patients that, for example, are on methadone. Methadone is looked down upon in our society, and I think it's just not understood the role that methadone plays in a patient's recovery. I think it has a valid role in that recovery process and the healing.
Chuck, do you ever have discussions about the use of methadone as far as an employer is concerned?
No, it hasn't really come up. We don't get that deep into it. I mean, sometimes we discuss casually the various drugs or substances, but really what we're focused on is how much it's going to cost the employer, in terms of the loss of the employer treatment or what have you. We do sometimes try to verify that they're receiving treatment. Sometimes we want verification, but we may not actually get into, if they're getting methadone treatment or not.
So if you don't know if that's a I forget the term when it's a drug that they can get real easily and it's a formulary. I'm not saying it right. But it's a regular part of their medical maintenance. Like I take Coumadin. I mean, I don't have to deal with anybody as far as I get that regularly. It's sort of nondescript.
The problem with methadone is that it will test as an opioid, and if you're doing a drug test in the workplace, it'll come up, and just the same as heroin, unless you have a methadone-specific test, which is more expensive. So the employer would have to be, forthcoming in saying that they're on methadone.
And if they said that, Chuck, what do you think might be the response?
Well, then that's where we get into issues of verification. I mean, if you're getting methadone, it's just because of a treatment, some sort of treatment that you're receiving, and you know, we may want verification of that.
Okay. So it might not be an automatic no.
No, it wouldn't be an automatic. It may not be an automatic no. No, it depends on the job, the person, the industry, things, you know, the business, things like that.
Well, there's also stigma attached to methadone, so the employer might, you know, look at that. I look at methadone in that way.
Well, it's an indication of maybe a past problem or a current problem, but you know, if that employee's or candidate serious under consideration for hire, or if it's an otherwise really good employee, I mean, you know, I guess it becomes a cost-benefit analysis.
By the way, our show just ended, and I thank you both for participating. The conversation was very nice, very lively, and I hope to do this again, and I would like to be able to call upon either or both of you to come back for another show.
Sure.
Okay, nice talking with you.
Thanks a lot, Ellen.
Too,
thanks a lot, Chuck.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.